My name is Junius Venugopal. Venugopal is a Hindu origin name from India. Venu is a flute and Gopal is a shepherd. So it's a flute playing shepherd. It's one of the incarnations of the Hindu god Krishna. But my father, whose name was a Hindu. He converted to Catholicism to marry my mother. So I was raised a Roman Catholic and came to know Christ when I was 25, 26 years old. And then subsequently shared the gospel with my parents, who both trusted Christ, and as did my sister and brother. So our whole family came to know the Lord. And so I think of Venugopal more like David, the flute-playing shepherd. And I grew up in India till I was 27 and came to the United States to do a master's in business administration. And during that time, I just become a believer in India and then came to the U.S. I was working in India and it was a crisis of sorts. I was selling microcomputers. I was an engineer and involved in microcomputer sales. And I was not meeting my quotas. So, you know, when you're in trouble, you go to God. And so I said, I went to God and there was no response, which led me to question and seek God out more, which then led to the fact that I heard the gospel, trusted Christ, come to America and a new believer. And in one of my Bible studies that I was part of, they asked the question, if you were to list your accomplishments in light of eternity, what would you write? And I realized I couldn't write anything. That even though I'd become a Christian, I was living with worldly ambitions. So all I wanted was more money and a bigger house and, you know, better clothes. And that led me to re-examine my life, which then led me to trust in Christ as or commit my life to a full-time ministry. I went to seminary, returned to India as a pastor for 8.5 years, and realized that church is very much like education. We're trying to equip people who are Christians in our church to become more like Christ. And so the only method I was taught in seminary was how to preach. And I said, no, I got to do more than that because I want members of the church to act like Christians, behave like Christians, and also lead people to Jesus themselves. It shouldn't be only my job. And so that whole idea in education that you are giving information or content and you're also causing your students to love the subject and then you want the students to actually be practical, use the content they are learning in the classroom in their life. And that idea said, hey, that's just what I should be doing with the church people. They should know about Jesus, they should love Jesus, and they should share Jesus with people. So I did my PhD in education, and the funnest part of my studies was I was looking at multicultural teams. So I went to Venezuela, Paraguay. I came here to Poland, and I went to East Germany. I went to Ethiopia and Kenya and looked at different multicultural teams working in, at that time, this was the mid-90s, lower socioeconomic places. So I didn't go to Europe, the Western Europe or America, North America. And I didn't go to Asia because I'm Asian, and I thought I'd prejudge, I'd presume the answers. And I wanted to go to places where I couldn't presume the answers. And I worked with multicultural teams. And there was one organization that had as its strategy, our team members who are planting this church, we're going to be multicultural. We're going to be people from every nation, tribe, you know, color, if you will. And we want to plant a church because of the fact that the kingdom of God is going to be like that. The kingdom of God is going to be multicultural. people of every nation, tribe, and kind. And so one of the people in the teams was having a very difficult time working with his teammates. And so there were two kinds of teams I looked at. One was the good kind, people were working well together, doing things well, and then the kind of people who were clashing all the time. And he said, I don't know why the headquarters is insisting on multicultural teams. It is so much easier if we were all people of one culture. You know, we communicate, we know the language, we understand each other's, and everything will go well. He said, I told them, this is nonsense. You shouldn't be doing this. And I said, did they respond to you? He said, yeah. He says, they sent me a telegram. Now, you know, I have to understand how old this story is, because I don't know if there are people here who don't know what a telegram is, but you do. Or you can understand it in terms of, they sent me a text back, and it was only one word. So he said, to my question, we are bleeding to death here, they said, bleed. Which meant they were not being very responsive to the whole idea that there shouldn't be multicultural teams. That led me into the whole study of how do you work with people who are from different cultures and different communities. My wife is a North American. Her grandparents or great-grandparents migrated from Europe. One of her great-grandmothers is from the Czech Republic, and some on her great-grandfather's side, they're from Germany and England. So we've had some struggles in our own marriage, being married to a woman who was born and raised in the U.S., and I was born and raised, at least till I was 26, in India. But so what is cultural intelligence? It used to be that when people were missionaries or they were doing church planting in a particular community, they would spend time learning that culture, the customs, the language of that community. But they found that today, you don't have to, or you can't do that, because there are people from different cultures all around you. You go to work and you run into people from two or three cultures. You live in any big city, in anywhere in the world, and you've got people from two or three countries. But every once in a while, we'll run into some issues that have to do with knowing or understanding or being able to recognize aspects of cultural intelligence. So here is a young family in Greenland living in an igloo, and they're reading the children's poem of Little Jack Corner sat in a corner eating his pudding and pie. He put it, you know, so the idea of Little Jack Horner sitting in a corner, and so the little boy asked, what's a corner? Because if you live in an igloo, there are no corners. Everything is a curvature. And so that is basically what they are saying is an element of cultural intelligence. You're coming across practices, language, ideas, which are different from yours. And how do you react to that? And what do you do? How relevant can we be? This is a picture from a book by Sheen and Sheen on cultural leadership that talks about that aspect of, you know, how do we communicate and act when people are from different communities with different practices and language. One of the things I've realized is that when I'm communicating, I tend to think, even though I've spent a long time in the U.S., and I worked in the U.S., I worked in the Philippines for 6 years, I worked in India for 8.5 to 10 years, that images we convey are dependent on where we grew up. Just like this one is indicating. There's in India and other parts of Asia where it is wrong to correct an older person, even when they are, you know, blatantly wrong and everybody in the room recognizes them. Everybody keeps quiet because of their respect for an elder in your community. There are parts in America where that won't last even 1 second. And people will correct them right away. And in between, there are lots of different cultures. Some people will wait a little while for respect. Some people won't. And so what is the relevance of cultural intelligence, and how can we use it? So this, in Harvard Business Review, they talked about the fact that in a world where crossing boundaries is routine, cultural intelligence, or CQ, they now can measure your CQ, your cultural intelligence, just like they can measure your IQ, and they now are also able to measure EQ, which is emotional intelligence. So CQ can also be measured and tells you how you're able to cope with people from other cultures and communities, and talks about your exposure. Part of it is your exposure, and part of it is how you continue. So Daryl Bach has written a book, and he's one of the delegates or members or participants of this conference. He wrote a book where he defines culture according to the Oxford English Dictionary as consisting of the customs, arts, social institutions, achievements, and values of a particular nation, people, or social group. So culture, you know, you look at their customs, you look at their art, you look at their social institutions, behavior, social patterns, you know, how do they treat their father, how do they treat their mother, how are the children treated. My wife, being from America, was very strict with our children right from, you know, the first, second year of life, the idea of respecting. In India, they don't discipline their children till they're 2.5 or 3. And so the whole ideas are very different in the way she raised or wanted to raise the kids and what I wanted to do. And when they turned 13, 14, my wife would encourage my daughters. She'd say, "Hey, who are the cute boys in your class?" And I'd say, "Horrible. You don't do that. Girls are not supposed to talk to boys till they are 20 and married." You know? And so we had to do that in our own life and practice. So what are the social institutions? What are the achievements and values? But we want to start where Scripture talks about it, because not only is there cultural intelligence in terms of the fact people are from different ethnic groups, from different communities, but there's also cultural intelligence because we're talking about the world's culture and the culture from the Scriptures. And if you go into religions, there's Islamic or Muslim culture, there's Hindu culture, there's Buddhist. And there are elements of those cultures which, when we face, sometimes we don't know how to behave with them. With ethnic cultures, there's generally a tendency to respect someone from another country or another community. But if you're from the same, if you're from different religions, there tends to be less of a cultural acceptance and treatment. If you're from a different continent like Africa, or a different continent like Europe or Asia or South America, I'm more readily to accept you and to accept your practices. But if you say you're for a Muslim, then as a Christian, there tends to be some hesitancy, some fear. And similarly, for the Muslim, he might or she might fear a Hindu, and they might fear a Buddhist. And there is that whole aspect of religion and things like that. And so there is also that element of culture. So how does the Bible tell us to behave with people from different cultures? Here are some verses that talk about it. I did not, in my PowerPoint, write out the verses, and so I will read them out just for the lack of time, that we only have an hour and 15 minutes. But it's the same thing that's in your Bible that I'm going to read. I'm not going to read a different verse. But it talks about Ephesians 6:12, but the whole passage is from 10 to 18. So 6:12, Ephesians says, We do not wrestle. And that is the word for struggle. It's the word that is used for hand-to-hand combat. It's like wrestling, you know. Your hands are on me and my hands are on you, and we're really struggling. That's the connotation of, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So I want you to think of a culture that you're not comfortable with. Say, let's say it's Islam. Let's say it's a Muslim person that you feel a little bit more hesitant, or you see a Hindu practicing his or her, the ways of prayer by chanting or by other forms of ritualism, and makes you shrink. And what this verse is saying in 6:12 is that it's not the flesh and blood, it's not the person that you should be mad about, or you should be angry with, or you should be fearful of. That person is flesh and blood. But what you should be careful about is the rulers, the authorities, the philosophy, and the power, the spiritual evil power that is behind some of these practices. So how do you treat this person? You've got to respect this person according to your calling, according to your mission. How do you understand your calling, your mission? And as a Christian, I always believed that my first and primary calling is to share the gospel, is to love the other person to the kingdom of Jesus Christ. So I shouldn't get mad at them, and I'm not fighting them when they're talking to me about their religion or their cultural practice. I'm trying to be as nice as I can to those people, but I am still denying the philosophy that is they are espousing or talking about or wanting to be part of. Another verse is, I'll just go briefly over these six verses, but they are all saying the same thing. The idea is that the person who is saying something that you don't believe or you think is absolutely wrong, if they were a person from another religion, you should be so careful in how you communicate the gospel, how you communicate your opposing belief. 1 Peter 3:15 and 16 says, "But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you." So Peter is talking about the fact that we have hope in us because of Jesus Christ, that he is going to take us to heaven to be with him. And therefore, we do it, and it says, "Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame." So he's basically saying two things. When you meet these people and talk to them, you know, treat them with gentleness and respect. But it's very likely that you're going to be slandered, so you do it with a good conscience. Your responses to them, the way you behave, should be gentle, respect, even if you are being attacked. Make a defense. You know, what we all end to do is, why am I a Christian? I'm a Christian because I have a hope that Jesus saved me. And that becomes our major defense, our major attitude towards the people who are like that. Colossians 4, 5, and 6 says, "Walk in wisdom towards outsiders. Make the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person." So again, you can hear the words there. It says, let your speech always be gracious. Always means 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It means all the time. We are being gracious. There's no time when we can be mad and upset and angry at particularly people from other different cultures. It talks about the idea that we have our graciousness of speech is the same thing as what is being told in 1 Peter, where they're talking about being gentle and respectful. I'm going to skip around, and I don't want to keep repeating the same theme, but that's what all these six verses say. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, "Therefore we are ambassadors of Christ, God making his appeal through us. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God." It's a picture of our mission, how to behave as ministers of our gospel. Our mission is to plead with people to reconcile themselves with God. So when you're doing that and you come across someone who's a homosexual, how do you act with them? How do you treat them? When you come across someone who's practicing in sin, how do you treat them? How do you talk to them? Because they are living in the world's culture, and you and I are living in a different culture. The moment we condemn them, have we lost the audience? Are they going to listen to us? And more than that, the Bible never tells us to behave like that. If there's anything the scriptures talk about how we should behave and what we should be doing, it always talks about behaving well. And then talks about us in 2 Corinthians. Goes on to say that we are ambassadors of Christ. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, it talks about not being quarrelsome. It says the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone. So there is a whole theme in the way we behave with people from the world, whether they belong to the world's culture, whether they belong to a culture which thinks differently than I do, which acts differently than I do, and we don't get upset with them. Because your identity includes aspects of your culture, whether you agree to it or not. The fact that I'm married to an American doesn't make me an American, because I'm still an Indian. The fact that she's married to an Indian doesn't make her an Indian. We still encounter difficulties in our life and communication, even though we've been married 46 years as husband and wife. So despite that length of time, we still stumble over cultural ways of thinking that each of us do. But more importantly, what you have to recognize, sorry that line got sliced in half at the end, but when you see it on your PowerPoint, you'll see the whole thing. It says, I'm not only an Indian, I bear the image of God. You are not only a Polish person or a German or an American or an English person, you are the image bearer of God. You are being created in the Imago Dei. And as an image bearer of God, your cultural identity is included. It's not excluded. So everything about you, including the fact that you're a male or a female, the fact that you're a citizen of this country or that country, the fact that the color of your skin is one way or another way, is all part of the image of God. You reveal the image of God in the way you behave. And that is why I think culture is embedded in you. Now, of course, there are aspects of kinds of culture. So you can say the world's culture does not reflect the image of God. It mars it. We reflect a marred image of God because of the sin of Adam and Eve. And so as sinful beings, we cannot reflect the true image of God. Only one person could do that, and that was Jesus Christ. So all of us are showing aspects of the image of God, even the Muslim and the Hindu, but it's probably marred to a greater extent than it is in some of us. But the fact that I know my brother's Romanian, so I can see the fact that you're Romanian, is included in the part of the image of God as to who you are reflecting in Jesus. Here's how I thought was an excellent way that they dealt with the elements of cultural differences, because this chapter in 6:1, it talks about the fact that when the new church was just starting off, the Hellenistic Jews, the Jews who came from parts of Greece and where the Greeks had greater influence, had they'd come over for Passover, they were living with others being converted to Christ. So there were two kinds of Jews who were, because the initial conversions were all Jews. There were Jewish people who had lived and grown up in the land of Israel, and there were Jews who had come from other parts of the Roman Empire to Jerusalem for the Passover. They're becoming Christians. They noticed a problem that the widows who came from Greek origins or Greek lands were being mistreated in that they were not getting enough food. And so what is the solution that the apostles came up? They decided to appoint deacons. Every one of the deacons they appointed, all seven of them, were Greek Jewish deacons. They took the majority community of Jews who had become Christians from Israel, decided that since our brothers were having a problem in the way we were distributing food, we should let the deacons who distribute food all be Greek deacons. And the chief of them being, you know, Stephen. That was the most obvious name in terms of Greek. So there were seven men of good repute, full of spirit and wisdom. And in 1 Corinthians 9:20-21, Paul talks about being all things to all people so that in some ways some people will become Christian. He was going to accept the cultural nuances and idiosyncrasies, peculiar practices, best practices, everything about another community, because his chief goal was to be make the gospel evident and communicate that to him. So that's what's driving him. And of course, Revelation 7:9 says, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, were standing before the throne, before the Lamb. And again, so whoever I am, an Indian who's spent a lot of time in America, and I don't know what that means in terms of what culture I can call myself since it's so mixed up, but all of me is going to be in heaven. So the fact that I'm an Indian is going to end up by having that identity. Whoever you are, however you've been born and raised and exposed to different practices, all of that is going to be in heaven. And so those friends of mine who were planting multicultural churches with multicultural church planting teams, because they were living in big cities where there were people of every culture there, they're going to find all their people, even the people they disagreed with, up in heaven with them. I'll tell you an interesting story about my mother, whom I love very much, who's not on earth anymore, and my wife, whom I also love very much. We were 20, she was 21, and I was a little older than her, and my mother was in her mid-50s when she visited us. It was like we'd been married about a year, 10 to 12 months, and in India, it's very, very hot. So if you take out food which has been kept in the freezer, you can't leave it out on the counter very long, because the temperature right now is 100, I can say it's about 45, 46 degrees a good time to shake and bake, but that's the temperature there. So if you leave meat out at that temperature, it's going to get spoiled very quickly. But in Wisconsin, where it's much colder, one of my things my wife would do is take out meat that was in the freezer, leave it on the counter, come to it 3 or 4 hours, it would have thawed out, and she can work with that. This was before the time of microwave being in everyone's apartment and kitchen. And so my mother visited us. She was in bed, and my wife was still in college, so she left at early in the morning to go for classes. She said, by the time she comes back at 11 o'clock, the meat would have thawed, and she could cook lunch. And my mother woke up leisurely at 8 o'clock, and she saw the meat sitting there. She said, well, we better start working on that piece of meat. And then she said, well, because she didn't know my wife's schedule, she said, well, she'll be back, and she'll work on it. So it became 8:30. It became 9. And so she was getting nervous that we're going to waste a lot of meat. So she started putting it in the skillet and started trying to thaw it out and started cooking and everything else. And my wife strolls in at 10:30, 11, 11:30, and she sees that my mother's cooking the lunch. And she said, oh, I was going to cook lunch. And my mother's muttering under her breath, sure you were. Yeah. You left the meat on the counter. What do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to leave it alone, or I'm going to have to prepare it? And so my wife tells me at bed, doesn't your mother think I can cook? She's not letting me cook, you know? She prepared the lunch. And my mother was thinking to herself, what does this little girl think she's doing? She's making me the cook. And I came to relax and rest at my son's house for a few days. So this happens the next day. So she's got a class, so she takes the meat out of the freezer, sticks it on the counter, and goes off to class. And my mother wakes up at 8, and by 9 o'clock, 9:15, she's nervous that the meat has been sitting out for over an hour or so. So she starts cooking the food. By the time it happened on the third day, they were very irritated with each other. They were not talking to each other properly. There was this thing on my mother's side. She said, I came to relax. I didn't come to cook all the time, every meal. And my wife was thinking, and does this old woman not know that I can cook and produce some great food? What was happening was the whole idea of cultural miscommunication. My mother had never lived in North America. My wife had never lived in India. So they didn't know the basis for their thinking and communication. And I was a very good coward. I would just leave. I would just leave. Yeah, I am not going to get in the middle of two women, especially my mother and my wife.
Then they spoke out at the end.
Well, it took us a while. They both left, and then 6-7 months later, I was trying to figure out what was happening. And then I said, it has to be. Yeah, because we were trying to figure, they weren't talking. I mean, my mother wasn't talking to me for 6 months. But so then we were trying to figure out what happened. Why did you get upset? Then it comes out. It's basically the way different cultures live their lives. And you make presumptions without giving them a chance to explain themselves. That happens in communication with your neighbors. That happens in communication with people at work. And yet, we know that the best kind of solutions, the most difficult solutions, are solved by people who work from different cultures together. Because I can only see this part of the world. Everything from this side and backward, I can't see. If someone was to stand looking at that side, together, we can see all around the room. Because I can see this far and front, the person who's facing at the back can see around the room. But there's a problem. You have to trust each other. she has or he has to believe that I'm seeing two cameras in front of me and they can't see the cameras. I have to believe there's a screen behind me because that person can see the screen. And if I didn't trust that person because they took the meat out too early, and that person didn't trust me to know what I was doing, we're going to have big problems. And that's essentially what cultural intelligence is, like emotional intelligence. Why is 2 plus 2 equal to 4? Because my IQ tells me that's how math works. It's similar in cultural intelligence. I have to understand that the way that person is processing information is the way their culture taught them to process information. Here's something. If you go and touch a hot stove once, what happens? You get burnt. That's memory. If the second time, you won't touch it. So what memory is to an individual, that is what culture is to a community. So we are a shared information. Our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents have lived in the land we are living in. And because they've lived in that land and area, they know that this is a good thing. This is the best way to do things. This is efficient way. And so as a child growing up, I have to learn to listen to the adults. And the adults have to be kind to me because I'm a new kid. I will not know everything. So if they speak harshly, I'm not going to listen to them. And if I continue to disobey what they are giving me information on, they are going to get a little angry with me and upset in communicating that. So these are definitions of culture, our learned patterns of beliefs, values, assumption, and behavioral norms. They manifest themselves at different levels of observability. People might see how you act, but they don't know what you believe. And they have to talk to you to find what you believe. And behind that belief or under that belief are the values. What are the values that drive these beliefs, that drive this behavior? So you're always seeing the behavior at the out top. The assumptions, the values, and the beliefs are all hidden. So there are different ways of showing this in terms of espoused values, the cultural artifacts, the tacit cultural assumptions. If you go to the US, one of the things you notice is most of the houses are built out of wood. Not true all over the world. Some places they build them out of bricks and build them out of mud and clay. Do you know why it's built out of wood in the US?
Cheaper.
Hmm?
It is cheaper, there's more wood.
It's actually because the soil is bad. They can't make bricks. No, we do. Not enough. So there's facades of houses. You'll have bricks. But inside, it's wood construction. So, you know, the land you lived in created conditions for what became a primary place of using of this thing. This is what is known as cultural intelligence in a technical sense. A man called David Livermore, you can see his name on the thing, wrote a couple of books on cultural intelligence. And this is not only him, but it came out of Harvard University for the first time, and then it was in the Harvard Business School. So there's both secular, strong literature and publishings that indicate cultural intelligence is a thing. And it is, can be tested, it can be used, that we have, all of us have CQ drive, that is your level of interest, persistence, and confidence during multicultural interactions. It's, you know, you start by saying, why am I getting to know this person from a different culture or a different community? We all have different motivations. And when that motivation is strong enough to breach that cultural gap, Maybe you want to talk to that person. You heard that person playing music, and you love their music. And so you say, okay, I really want to hear this person play music more. Can I go and talk to him, or can I talk to her and get them to play this music again? Or you got to see them play some sport, and you say, wow, I want that person on my team. And then, you know, you get to bridge that culture, and you find there are little oddities in the culture. And now on social media, you can see those things. You know, say, of course, I'm an Iranian. I do this, 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 and this. You know, of course, I live in this part of the world. I don't know if you've seen that, but I've seen a lot of them on different social media channels. Then they talk about what are the peculiarities of their culture. So what is your level of interest? What drives you in this aspect? When they say what they want to define it, they say it is the curiosity and the motivation that is needed. But what you want to observe on them is energized, it is persistent in their approach to multicultural situations. People who have CQ drive want to get to meet people from other cultures and communities. They have clear personal motivations. They find joy in cross-cultural interactions. My mother and my wife did not have joy in their cross-cultural interaction, but they did want to persist in it because they loved me. And once we had children, then my mother was very motivated because she loved her grandchildren. And my wife was very interested in wanting to get to know my mother. So despite their initial clashes, they forced themselves to love each other because of the common elements that were there. And, you know, there are people who find deep joy in helping other people feel empowered and opening their mind to new ways of thinking on culture. You know, we take with the first family unit, male and female. We think differently. If you don't believe me, just get married and see what happens after 1 week and see how much of the grace and you have to extend to understanding how that other person is behaving. And if you want more fun, get married to someone from another culture. 46 years of pure joy. I'm kidding. But yeah, CQ drive, that curiosity, that motivation takes you to CQ knowledge. Then you want to know why. I want to know why you're behaving this way, or how are you thinking this way? And I do it because of the fact of my motivation. My motivation of drive brings me to knowledge. And so your understanding of how cultures are different, how they are similar. CQ knowledge is understanding of the kinds of differences that describes one group versus the next without stereotyping. One of the problems we tend to have is to say all Indians think like this or all Germans are like this. You'll find that there's no all involved. That there might be some generalities, but you'll also find people who are acting atypical from the norm or not your understanding. And that's the fun part of getting to know people, because they don't behave the way you think they're going to behave. We're all individuals. And God did a marvelous job in the way he created each one of us. The way you develop CQ knowledge is by talking to people who look, dress, and speak differently and are obviously from another culture. Are you interested in speaking to someone who dress differently? Are you curious about the way they do things? That's all CQ knowledge. People who have CQ knowledge read books and learn the common phrases used by people from different culture and community. You know, how do you say it's hello, and how do you say goodbye? Or when we came in for registration yesterday. You saw that chart outside, which had all welcome in so many different European languages. And that's, you know, one aspect of culture. What do you do as an ambassador of Christ when you meet with someone from another community or culture or language or behavior? Let's all seek your knowledge. Strategy is awareness and ability to plan multicultural interactions. Now, my children grew up overseas. So they grew up in America, but in India for half their lives, and then in the Philippines for the other half of their lives. So they never ever lived in a native culture that was common to them. So when they are coming back and going to college, and they're meeting people of the opposite gender, and falling in love and getting to know each other and becoming friends, they have to recognize there are going to be differences. My son married a girl whose parents had also been missionaries. So she had grown up in the Philippines and India, and they met when they were in the final year of high school. So they had a lot of commonality amongst themselves, and they could understand each other. But my daughter married a man who had never left the state of South Carolina in his whole life. And she had lived in India and Philippines and in America. So I think that marriage would have been fun for her first few months, wouldn't it have been? Just like mine was. But, you know, I think so they need to strategize, which is what we told them to do. Think about when you both start quarreling and getting upset with each other, that there is a rational basis for it. When I came to the United States, I lived in New York, and then my wife had lived in Wisconsin. We married, we were trying to save money. So when we moved to Texas for me to go to seminary, the first thing we did is, our rule when we were living in Wisconsin was no air conditioning in the car. We're going to roll down the windows and enjoy. And in Wisconsin, you can do that and get away with it. You cannot do it in Texas, because we went down there and we were very poor. And so we said, we're not going to, you know, spend more money on air conditioning our car. So we kept there. But one thing we noticed, every time we were in the car driving anywhere, after 5 minutes, we were fighting with each other. And after about 4 or 5 days of fighting with each other, and we noticed that happened only when we were in the car. It did not happen when we were inside the house. And I said, okay, what if we turn on the air conditioning and see if we can increase our fighting, stays the same, or lowers it? It went away. And that is because other things in life bother you and irritate you and raise your frustration level. Then you need a little bit on the top to take it off. So what happens in the day? You get up in the morning and you're getting out of bed and you're walking to the bathroom or the toilet to brush your teeth and wash your face, and your toe hits against the door and you start jumping, and then you go in and you turn on the tap and no water. And then you said, okay, fine, I can eat breakfast without brushing my teeth. So you go to the kitchen and you start cooking up a food, but it's not coming out the way it was meant to in your mind, which it was very delicious, but now it's not tasting. Say there's no pepper, there's only salt, you can't add enough ingredients. Your frustration level that day has increased. And then all it needs is a little bit more of irritation and you're going to blow your top. That's what happens with all of us in our lives. We just need that frustration to build up. If I got up, I didn't stub my toe, if I brushed my teeth and there was water, I go in, the food was prepared, my frustration level is very low. I have a lot of tolerance in my life. You can say anything to me and I'm not going to get mad at you. But in the previous scenario, there was going to be a little tolerance only left for irritation. So we need to strategize. We need to think, what do I need to do, or how do I need to act? And then CQ action is taking that strategy of thinking effectively and adapting it when we are relating and working in multicultural communities. So we need to start thinking in terms of making the effort to culturally adapt. We're looking at verbal, nonverbal cues. When I get angry, the way I try and control myself is become very polite. I said, yes, thank you, sir. Thank you, man. So when I get like that, I start recognizing, okay, what's going on with you? But my friends all know that. They say, okay, what's wrong with you? Where are you getting, what's irritating you? And I said, nothing's irritating me, sir. Oh, yeah, right. Why did you say sir? So I'm just being polite. So no, you're trying to control yourself. What's going on? So how we act and how we adapt our behavior also give cues on how we live and move.